Tēnā tātou katoa, I am Rebecca Wright. Nō mai, welcome to News Hub Nation. This morning, no budget bump for Labor, but could a new policy do the trick? We are live to Wellington, where Simon Shepherd is with the Deputy Prime Minister. Scrutiny stressed, Adrian Orr feels personally attacked at his press conference, but why? And Finn Hogan is here with his digital power rankings and what's been making waves online. Well, Labor's election campaign unofficially begins today, and party members are gathering in Wellington for the Labor Party Congress at Te Papa. And we have our man on the ground there too, Simon Shepherd, who joins us now. And Simon, what's happening down there?
Right, yes, good morning, everybody. This is a packed room of 400 delegates. Labor through and through. They're listening to President Jill Day give the opening remarks at the moment. But we are going to have a morning of heavy hitters here. After her, there's going to be Deputy Labor Leader Kelvin Davis, Grant Robertson and Carmel Cepelloni. Somebody who is not here is the Prime Minister. He's been given a leave of absence this morning to go watch his kids' football game in Upper Hutt because he's been travelling so much in the last 7 days and he hasn't seen the kids. He'll be back, though, to see Grant Robertson give a speech. And from the conferences that I've seen before, when Grant Robertson gets up, it's all about attacking the opposition.
Hey, he always puts on a good show, doesn't he, Simon? And for those of us, you know, not sure steeped in Labor Party minutiae, what is the difference between a Congress and a conference?
It's very important. It's all about election year. Normally a conference, Labor holds us towards the end of the year and they go through the minutiae of developing policy protocol and procedure. This year they brought it forward. It's called a Congress because it's election year and it's not about developing those procedures. It's about getting to know the candidates. All the new candidates are going to be standing in October. They even have a meet the candidates session this afternoon, and one particular one that I've sort of picked out is Mr. Whippy. His name is George Hampton. He's standing for North Shore in Auckland. He has a franchise owner of Mr. Whippy, but he's also a Fulbright scholar, a Harvard educated, and a former advisor to Helen Clark. So it'll be interesting to see that range of new candidates up on stage later on.
Yeah, very diverse background there. But there are promises to Simon of a new policy today.
That's right. It seems that Labor has decided to draw a line in the sand over super. That's their phrase. And overnight they released costings that the Labor Party leader's office has done, which claims to show that a 30-year-old would be about $100,000 worse off by the time they hit retirement if National and ACT policies on superannuation and KiwiSaver were implemented. Labor has really sensed the vulnerability there, and we sort of believe that this is the kind of line that they're going to be carrying on to run today. It's about countering that coalition of chaos line that Chris Luxton is running out, and they're going heavily on that sort of coalition of cuts line. I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that today.
Yeah, it's an interesting battleground. We look forward to coming back to you very soon. Simon Shepherd there in Wellington. Well, let's go live now to Jill Day, who is Labor's president. She is stirring up the crowd, rallying the troops with an opening address.
They deliver a third term for our Labor government. Every member, all of us, our people, you are what has always and will always be what makes our party Labor. Our Prime Minister will always choose to do the right thing. Our party will remain principled. Our leaders will always strive for social justice, and our party will hold to our strong foundations. We are the people that uphold Te Tiriti and the party that lives its values. We are the people that open our doors to all and the party that makes everyone feel like they belong. This is who we are. That is what we stand for. Ko tātou te ropu reipa, ko te ropu reipa, ko tātou. You are the Labor Party and the Labor Party is all of us. Nō reira e te whānau o te ropu reipa. In the words of our Prime Minister, let's get on with it. Nō reira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa.
Well, that is the new Labor Party President, Jill Day, there, and I look forward to getting to know a little bit more about her. But as we heard earlier, we are expecting a policy today from Deputy PM Carmel Cepelloni. We're expecting that to drop during her speech at 11:30. But Simon Shepherd sat down with her moments ago to try and extract what we can expect from that policy.
Something to do with safeguarding our future, around superannuation and just really drawing a line in the sand today is what we're doing.
So safeguarding the future, are you worried that the current New Zealand super rates aren't enough to live a dignified life? Are you raising them?
Well, we certainly know that our universal scheme works for New Zealanders. We've had fear-mongering, really, from the opposition parties. ACT has already said that they're going to lift the age. We've had National in the past cut contributions to the super fund, which puts our superannuation at risk.
Right.
And so it's important that we draw a line in the sand.
Okay, a line in the sand. So you're saying that you're not touching super, or are you tinkering with super? What are you doing?
I'm going to announce today what we're doing as a political party.
Yeah.
I won't do it in this interview, but we're very proud of the superannuation scheme that we've got and believe that it's important.
Okay. Is the superannuation scheme sustainable? It's $18 billion a year at the moment, rising fast, and the percentage of population that's going to be eligible is also rising fast as well.
Treasury says it's affordable, and so that's what we go by. As long as we continue to contribute to the superannuation fund, that's the most important thing. We lost about $24 billion when the previous National government decided to stop contributing.
Yep.
I think that's a very clear indication that they are not the best managers of the economy.
Why are you choosing superannuation to draw a line in the sand? Labor released costings overnight about how in theory, somebody would be worse off under a National ACT coalition in terms of super. Why superannuation? Because doesn't it open you up to this idea that you're not fiscally responsible because superannuation costs are going to blow out?
Well, they're not going to blow out. Treasury's already said that they won't, as long as we continue to contribute to the super fund, which Labor has always been committed to. KiwiSaver was developed by a Labor Party, by a Labor government. It was something that wasn't supported by a National government. But if we didn't have it, then thousands of New Zealanders would not have savings going into retirement, which is also really important.
It's not a holistic thing. I mean, you know, National is proposing tax cuts, and they're also, you know, ACT saying, you know, we'll take that money to reduce debt, and maybe it could go into other areas of government spending. More productive ones.
Well, they've talked about tax cuts, but they haven't said what they would need to cut in order to provide those tax cuts. I think we need a little bit of public transparency and honesty with the general public, because New Zealanders deserve to know what they will be giving away, and that may include superannuation if they're getting tax cuts.
Okay, so in terms of transparency, do you have concerns about the way the New Zealand superannuation, New Zealand Super is set up at the moment in terms of age eligibility for Māori and Pacifica?
Well, certainly the evidence is there to support that Māori and Pacific, unfortunately, die younger. They're more likely to work in those labour-intensive jobs, which mean that they won't be able to work past 65, or they will need super. And yet still, we do see a disproportionate number of Māori working beyond 65 because of the fact that financially they need to. So this is something that we need to look at seriously.
The Retirement Commissioner has suggested a ROPU, an advisory board on Māori and Pacific eligibility for superannuation. Is that something that you're considering? I mean, would you consider dropping the age of New Zealand superannuation eligibility for Māori and Pacific?
That we're looking at now, but we do need to make sure that we're investing in our health system to actually extend the age or you know, life expectancy of Māori and Pacific, so that we don't have the disparity that we currently have.
Okay, so can you confirm that you're not looking at dropping the age of eligibility for certain ethnicities?
Don't want to announce the policy now, but clearly.
But you could rule that part out, couldn't you?
Well, clearly, and you're asking me, but you know, clearly that's not the case.
That is not the case.
Yeah.
All right. So are you going to increase benefits? Are you going to increase the super rate?
Well, we already did that on the 1st of April. And we've done that a number of times over the course of the last 5 years. So we've been very much focused on all New Zealanders, particularly those that are on low to middle income New Zealanders. We saw benefits go up, student allowances go up, superannuation go up on the 1st of April. And so we've certainly been focused on doing that and minimum wage, and we've made those shifts.
Let's go back to fiscal sustainability. Is New Zealand out of step with other countries who are similar, i.e. Australia? So from July this year, to get the age pension in Australia, you will have to be 67.
Well, 65, as I said, currently, according to all the research, is still affordable for us if we continue to invest in the super fund. Also, you know, in terms of the amount that superannuation costs us, we're actually spending less as a country than other countries in the OECD on average.
So the OECD has recommended to New Zealand to raise the age.
We're not spending as much as others in accordance with GDP. And so I think that, you know, it's very clear, according to the figures that we've been given, that it is still affordable.
Are you sure that there are not unintended consequences for other areas like health and education if you carry on with eligibility at 65?
Not if we continue to invest in the super fund and we take a responsible approach to the overall economy, which is absolutely what we've done. I think we really need to dispel this myth that's out there that National are good at managing the economy. I just want to go back to the fact they stop investing in the super fund. That costs New Zealanders $24 billion. And so that's a lot of money that we miss out on because of their decision making.
So Labor is really focusing in on this. You believe there's a chink in National's and ACT's armour here, that New Zealanders actually want to keep their superannuation eligibility at 65,
New Zealanders,
despite the cost.
New Zealanders want assurance that they are going to be supported when they go into their retirement. They also want to be assured that it is affordable. So it's about making sure that we're able to provide that assurance, but that we're doing what is responsible to ensure that we're able to pay for these things in the out years.
Yeah. So it's the coalition of cuts line. I mean, you have come out ahead of the Congress, which is a rah-rah situation to get Labor up and running for election, and you've come out attacking. Is this the coalition of cuts line that the Prime Minister's been running?
Well, they are a coalition of cuts. Let's be fair on that. They also have not been honest and transparent with New Zealanders around how they are going to pay for their tax cuts. New Zealanders want to know that they're going to be supported. They also want to know that the government agencies and the supports they need through health and education are going to be there for them. So we need to know from the opposition what they are
aiming for. This Congress is about Labor Party policy. So just sort of one final chance. Can you tell us what you are going to be releasing today, tinkering around the edges of New Zealand Super?
I'm going to announce it this morning. It's important that we have an opportunity to share that with the party membership that are here, and so you're going to have to wait a little while, Simon.
Deputy Prime Minister Carmel Cipollone, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Simon Shepherd there with Carmel Cipollone, who's clearly pushing superannuation as a battleground at the soft launch of Labor's election campaign. But we're going to go back to the Congress now and to Calvin Davis, who is giving a speech.
Sadly, there are political parties in New Zealand that do not share our worldview and values. They are disingenuous and they lack authenticity. We know their worldview is dominated by the cost of everything and the value of nothing. One small example is they are bemoaning the cost of producing and distributing the Matariki Karakia books that Willow Jean Prime launched 2 weeks ago. I think they cost about just over $3 each. They ignore the value, they know the cost, but they ignore the value that those same booklets will bring to thousands of communities across Aotearoa as we look to celebrate Matariki again this year. We know that whenever they are in government, the interests of those in real need goes backwards, while the interests of their mates always improves. Let's look at the ACT Party, a group whose policy proposals are so ludicrous, it's often hard to know if they are serious or just designed to infuriate. Their value system is the antithesis.
Calvin Davis there addressing the Labor Party Congress in Wellington. Amuri ina whakatairanga, we will be back with our political panel, Mike Williams, Isabel Ewing and Dilipa Fonseca soon, plus digital editor Finn Hogan with the trials and tribulations of our MPs online. Hoki mai anō, welcome back. Well, it was a big week down in Wellington with the much-anticipated official cash rate announcement on Wednesday. Often it seems like the Reserve Bank and its governor speak their own language, live in their own monetary policy bubble. Their analysis and commentary is focused on mortgage holders and financial markets. But we wanted to know what Adrian Orr, one of the most important decision-makers in our economy,
has to say to ordinary working people, those who arguably feel the pain of the cost of living crisis most. So here is our political editor, Jenna Lynch, with the Reserve Bank Governor.
There's always a lot of focus on mortgage holders, but what about everyday working New Zealanders, the 430,000 people that are falling behind on their loans, struggling to pay bills, struggling to put food on the table? What is your message to them?
Our message to them is that inflation is no one's friend, and it is inflation that is causing the most significant economic challenge at present to all New Zealanders, and our job is to return inflation back to its 1% to 3%. What I'd like to say to them is that we're well on the path to achieving that.
But those same people are the ones that would be hurt in a recessionary environment, in a downturn. They don't seem to be a major feature in any of your commentary or analysis. Why is that?
I disagree with your supposition. There is significant, in fact, an entire chapter around the labour market, labour force and maximum sustainable employment.
Those people can't, in your words, cool their jets with their spending. They're borrowing to get the basics. And what they hear from you is that what we're seeing is what we're hoping to observe. Do you feel like you're in touch with the pain that people are feeling right now?
I don't know that comment. So what I'm saying is absolutely we're in touch. Inflation is no one's friend, and we are here to stamp inflation out with monetary policy. I will also point out that unemployment has been at record low levels. Employment and employment engagement in the economy is at OECD record levels, but we need to constrain inflation.
And do you personally take some responsibility for the inflationary environment that we're seeing right now?
I am the Governor of the Reserve Bank. Yes, I do.
In taking some responsibility for the inflationary environment which we find ourselves in, on reflection, were any of your actions avoidable, and do you regret any of the actions that you have taken?
I regret that the public of New Zealand has had to suffer through this high inflation period. I also acknowledge that that's been the case internationally through the story. But in terms of the decision-making that we've had to make through it as a committee, no, we have talked and published our full review. And I'll remind listeners that that is public and it was internationally reviewed and is available. And we talked about, probably in hindsight at best, we could have started raising interest rates 3 to 6 months earlier than what we actually did. But that would have been a small beer difference with regards to the end inflation outcome.
And do you feel like you've been adequately accessible, accountable, and faced an acceptable level of in-depth scrutiny over what impact your decisions have had on the cost of living crisis in New Zealand?
Can I remind that it's a committee decision, because I'm feeling very personally attacked here, so I will just remind you of that. It's a Monetary Policy Committee. And yes, I do. We are in front of the public very often, and we're in front of Parliament very often. In fact, at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning, I'm back in front of the Financial Expenditure Committee meeting, and we have done significant international reviews. And we are one of the most, if not the most, transparent central bank on planet Earth.
Well, big call there by the Reserve Bank Governor, Adrian Orr, who we've been asking for an in-depth interview for 12 months now. Well, with me now is our political panel, News Hub's climate correspondent Isabel Ewing, former Labour Party President Mike Williams, and Dilipa Fonseca, who is senior correspondent for Business Desk. Good morning. Welcome to you all.
Thank you.
Some really awkward moments there with Adrian Orr sort of responding to this different sort of line of questioning. He said he felt personally attacked at one point. Mm. But that's scrutiny, isn't it? That's a big job he's got, Mike.
It is, but he's also got to walk a tightrope.
Mm-hmm.
People hang on his every word, and there's really in-depth analysis at what he says. So I do have some sympathy for him. And he made the point that one of his objectives is low unemployment, and he's got that. So I think he defended himself fairly well. I don't think he was justified in saying he was under attack, though.
Yeah, what did you think, Isabel?
Yeah, I feel like perhaps he should have been briefed maybe better. You know, that seemed like that question just came out of the blue for him. What about the people who are struggling? What about those people? And he just didn't seem prepared. Sort of that one of the answers from Jenna, I think, he said, I don't know that comment. And he kept repeating inflation is no one's friend. And everybody is aware that inflation is nobody's friend. So perhaps a bit of lack of prepping for the Reserve Bank governor on that question.
It wasn't his natural habitat, was it? What do you think, Dilipa? You are steeped in the mystery of the Reserve Bank.
Well, the system is set up so that he's not the most popular guy in the room, right? And it's at a period of high inflation, it's set up so he's independent so that he can make a hard call and an unpopular call. And that's why we've set it up that way. What he perhaps didn't explain very well was that it's set up so that he's the second responder. So the government comes in with their budget, and they're supposed to deal with the social issues and cost of living issues and things like that. They're supposed to, and then the Reserve Bank is supposed to step in as in response to that and say, right, this is where interest rate or the official cash rate needs to be in order to keep inflation down. So we've set him up a little bit there, to be fair, to be the unpopular guy in the room.
But when you're pulling those levers, do you also sort of have to, you're serving all New Zealanders, you have to be able to relate to the experience of everybody, do you think, Mike?
Well, I think he has to, and he will know that, but he kind of defended that with the employment statistics. Mm. You know, if you're feeling the pinch, get a better job.
I want to move on now because it is an exciting day down in Wellington at Te Papa. It is the Labour Party Congress. We have seen this morning that they're going to go on the attack. We've heard a coalition of cuts and also the super policy, Dilipa. What do you think about that as a battleground for the election?
It's a bit of a strange policy because it's not necessarily a battleground that people want to discuss. I mean, part of the reason why we've had such difficulty in this debate is that no one actually wants to discuss the superannuation issues, because one of the big problems, I mean, Australia is making changes in this area, because the big issue with superannuation is actually not the people who are retiring, 10, 20, 30 years from now. It's actually people who are going into retirement, in the next few years, who will be living longer. And therefore, in 20, 30 years, we're going to have potentially a big budget problem.
Are you surprised, Mike, that this is what's being wheeled out at the Congress?
No, I'm not that surprised, because I listened very carefully to what Carmel Cipollone said, and she was also attacking National's reputation of being a better economic manager. They did, in fact, stop payments into the Cullen Fund, which cost us $24 million. So I think that is part of the attack on National. I am, like Dilip, I'm a bit surprised that superannuation is an issue, because I haven't noticed it as an issue.
It is interesting. Isabel?
I would agree with Mike. I think it's quite a shrewd sort of battleground to take, because it's an opportunity to feed into that rhetoric of this is a coalition of cuts and a reminder of what you lost under a former National government. So perhaps that's more the strategy there.
Yeah. Is it unusual, Mike, to go on the attack at a Congress? I think of these things as quite, inward focused about what we are doing, but this is very much lining up National and ACT.
It is unusual, but I think it's necessary given their position in the polls. But I would make a point that they're not using half the ammunition that's open to them. I mean,
you've got some ideas. Well, got a little PowerPoint here.
I'll give you this. This is a report on Brooke Van Velden.
My gosh, yes.
And she says they're going to cut KiwiSaver subsidies, scrap the winter energy payment, lower benefits, put interest back on student loans, and reduce public servant salaries. Well, that is wonderful meal for the Labor Party.
Well, you can take the Labor Party president out of the party, but you can't take it out of the man or something, Mike. Dilipa, it was a bit of a grim week maybe a sobering week for Labor this week with the poll out. Do you think the honeymoon is over for Hipkins?
When you look at some of the polling, or at least, on Business Desk, we have a rolling average of polls. And one thing we noticed was this week was in that rolling average was the first week where Luxon's kind of, National is kind of edged ahead. And when you look at how those averages go out, it's actually a lot of Labor's popularity is sort of going upwards when you have the storm event or the cyclone, and it's sort of trending down. So, but on the other hand, you know, you would say that National, perhaps there's an argument out there that maybe National isn't doing as well as it could have, which has caused some of the other tensions this week, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And we haven't, we've seen Christopher Luxon an inch, I think, 1 point higher, which is quite unusual, isn't it, that you have the party doing well, but actually, If it was an election tomorrow, we might have a Prime Minister who's not super popular, Isabel.
No, and it seems like that kind of the notion of Chris Luxon being inexperienced and being a little bit shaky on his feet compared to the political animal that is Chris Hipkins seems to be potentially bedding in a little bit. I mean, Dilipa and I were both at a press conference with Chris Luxon last week or maybe earlier this week, and he did seem very unnerved by that poll result and, you know, unsettled by it. And then we see him at a public meeting in Birkenhead and potentially just having another whoops moment where he comes out and says the medium density housing rules were, what were his words, not perhaps a mistake. And so maybe a little bit uneasy on his feet coming into an election year and allowing for some easy wins by Labour.
Well, it's very late to be finding your feet, isn't it, Dilipa?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was a kind of classic case in point because it wasn't clear. I mean, if that was that's a big shift in policy because they made a big deal of this being a bipartisan accord. So if they're planning to tack away from it, that's not the way that you announce it. So it looked like he accidentally said something and then they didn't talk about what they meant for a little while, and I guess we'll see in the next few days what that actually means. But it's it, and I mean, there were other things that he said in that meeting, I think, around Māori names on signs.
Yes.
And I think that it just looked panicky. I mean, if you want to make a point about this, there's a way of going about it. But it looked like he was panicked by the crowd and sort of seemed to make some points that he perhaps didn't mean to say out loud.
Which is great for us journalists, but not good if you're wanting to get elected as Prime Minister.
Yeah. And sort of undermining his deputy, Nicola Willis, who was so instrumental in that bipartisan accord, you know, with Chris Bishop, and then sort of letting that out kind of... Yeah, you have to think behind the scenes there might be a little bit of tension between...
Maybe some coaching for Christopher Luxon.
And it's not even clear that that was costing them popularity, because all through last year, I mean, this was a position they had and their popularity only rose. What is the strategy here? I mean, what votes are they trying to get?
I think the danger is that Chris Luxon appears to be trying to secure the 25% of people who vote National anyhow, with the live cattle exports and the housing policy he announced. But I would make a point. What these polls, and there have been several over the last week, Horizon had the Greens and Labor ahead, it's going to be a very near-run thing. So, and under those circumstances, you look at two things. Who's going to... shine in the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Helen Clark was the discovery of the campaign in 1996. Didn't win, but she was the discovery of the campaign. Phil Goff flopped. Okay? So did Judith Collins.
Yes.
If Luxon shines in the campaign, he's got a chance. Now, the other thing is who participates. The non-vote varies between 30 and 20%. If it's more like 20 than 30, Labor gets back in.
Yeah.
If it's more like 30 than 20, it's a National government.
Yeah, it is. It is going to be so interesting—a drag race right until the end. And I'm so interested in who's going to stay home too. But we will have to leave that for another day. Thank you so much for joining us on the panel this morning. Well, FI Akine, we will check in with Simon for the latest from the Labor Party Congress and the farmer turned MP who learned to send his first email after he'd entered Parliament. But it's time now for one of my favourite parts of the show, backstory. When ACT MP Mark Cameron entered Parliament, he only owned one suit and his partner had to teach him how to send an email. The halls of power were another planet for this farmer of 33 years, and it's been a journey for him. His heart, though, remains at home on his farm in Ruawai. So we travelled to his picturesque Taitokoro paradise to hear his backstory.
33 years I've been in Ruawai, cracking good place. Home is where the heart is, and it's certainly here for me in Northland. So many of my neighbours know who I am, I know them, and we share the passion of what we do in rural New Zealand. You can't not talk about a cow or social events. When there's a barbecue, someone's always talking about how much milk's being made and how little is being made. Oh, my favourite cow, gracious me, she's here somewhere.
Darling was her name, and she's an absolute darling. Big framed, fantastic udder, and yeah, she happens to be a family pet, so yeah, absolutely part of the family.
I was born in Australia in the early 70s. That's my mother. I was raised by a solo mum. You know, my mother left my father for reasons that everyone has, difficulties in a marriage. I didn't really know my biological father until I was in my 30s. I met him when I was, gracious me, I think I was 33. In the interim, my mother remarried, and I was eight going on nine there. And what a tremendous man. Like, he really taught me the value of all things.
Yeah, now and again we get a bit stretched on farm or in Parliament, but equally so, I'm exceedingly lucky. I've got a partner that runs this farm in my absence.
Now, I got on a dating website and I was like, oh my Lord, what am I doing? And Jody answered, right? So, good story.
Went out to dinner in Whangarei, and the first question he asked me was, would I prefer Batman or Spider-Man?
Yeah, I actually did, right? Well, it's a spandex thing, and I thought, well, Batman's certainly the better kind of person. And how she answered it decided whether we went out on a second date.
And I chose Batman, so that was apparently the right answer to choose.
She's the boss of me, really. I'm seldom...
I like the sound of that.
Yeah. No, it's really cool, and it's a shared journey, right? We love what we do in rural New Zealand, and we love farming. And I think as a family, you know, our children have all grown up in an environment where their parents, to some degree, have a farming, you know, background, love of farming, love of the land. We've got four children between us. I've got two older children, and
I've got two younger ones.
Yeah, very capable young people, and we're bloody proud of them.
Immensely proud, yeah.
Oh, I suffered, depression quite badly, and a lot of it is isolation. Blokes are shocking at communicating. And I think the thing is, when you're isolated, you're a male anyway, and you're rough and tumble, you're a farmer, right? So you don't have those issues, but really and truly you do. And I learnt to actually get rid of it, and if for want of a better word, by actually sharing the story and saying, hey, look, you can be as big and strong and as capable as you like, but in all that, you're still human. And so now I go and help other people advocate for it's all right to not be all right, and equally you can still be a bloody good farmer out the other side of it. When we were kids, my mother remarried and had my younger brother and younger sister as well. Very sadly for us as a family, my younger brother passed away with cancer when he was in his early 20s, so that's hard for us to see because the family's changed.
Oh, gracious me, I talked to three people in a week up in Rawai, and equally so, you talk to 30 in the space of an hour down in Parliament. But it's about representing what I do, and I genuinely love farming, and I think from my point of view, having loved it my entire life and wanting to do it since I was a little guy, you take that story into other people's thinking, and you take it to Parliament, and by virtue of that, you share in the narrative of all things rural.
All our farmers and growers identify with who they are by what they do. Ever increasingly, that identity is being taken from them.
People here are really good people. They're genuinely engaged in what each other is doing. And, you know, there's you might say a wider family narrative. And it's all about what we share in, and that's the love of farming.
Yeah, it's always nice to hear from our MPs and their backstories, their families, blended, solo parents. Lovely to hear from Mark Cameron there. Stay with us at Te Iwi. We are back after the break. Well, Hoki Maiano, welcome back. It was the jewel in the budget crown for Labor, $1.2 billion to subsidise 20 hours of childcare a week for two-year-olds. Precious money in the back pocket for parents during a cost-of-living crisis, but it is quickly turning sour. Early childhood teachers say that the conditions attached are impossible and could lead to higher prices and centres closing down. Simon sat down with one centre director, Kelly Seberg, and asked why she thinks this policy is a lemon.
We were absolutely elated. The problem was that the next day when we're diving into the detail, we realised that our ability to actually implement this successfully for the government is being rather thwarted by the conditions that they've attached to that additional funding.
$133 in the back pocket for a parent, I mean, that seems like a game changer. It allows them to go back to work or go back to training as well.
100%. Look, we want to be able to pass on that reduction in parent fees. We want to be able to do that. So the problem is we've got conditions that mean that we cannot ask parents to have a co-payment and cross-subsidise the money that we actually receive from the government for those 20 hours.
Right, so when their child is there under the 20 hours subsidised, you can't ask for a top-up.
No, that's exactly right. And the difficulty is, particularly for two-year-olds, we are funded on a 1 to 10 basis. Now, for two-year-olds, you can appreciate that that is simply not quality, that's not safe. And so we already staff our toddlers to a much higher ratio than that, and our parent fees help to cross-subsidise and make it affordable.
So you're saying that this funding that is being offered is on a 1 to 10 basis?
That's exactly right. And even with 1 to 10, it doesn't even cover the cost of delivering that. So we do rely on parents to help us to make that, deliver that program for them.
So are you saying that if you, as a centre manager, mm-hmm. agree to this funding model, that would affect a toddler's care?
Okay, so as I was saying, if we can only utilise the government's 20 hours subsidy, we would have no choice but to increase the number of children per adult, per teacher that we have. So that's not quality and that's not care at all. That is not, and in fact, it actually goes against the Early Learning Action Plan that the government has set out.
Is that the key point, that a toddler's care would not be optimal because they just don't have the teacher ratio? That is the key point?
That is the key point. The only other way we could possibly make some of these, make it work, would be to reduce our opening hours. You know, we could operate at 6 hours a day and possibly make it work, but is that really meeting the needs of our parents?
And 6 hours a day is the most that you can get in terms of that free subsidy?
Well, that's right, per day.
Per day.
In fact, that's one of the other crazy conditions that have come along with it, is that they said a parent could come and say, actually, I only want 2 hours today. Okay, well, that's lovely, but then if they wanted that between 11 and 1, how am I meant to fill that child's space between, you know, sort of 9 and 12 in the morning and then perhaps from 3 till 5 in the afternoon?
So you're saying it's not possible to staff for small periods of time?
No.
It's not effective.
Because you can imagine our teachers, we employ them all day. And so that's just not workable.
There seems to be some confusion over the funding rates. I've heard the Kindergarten Association say it's going to be like $7 to $9 per hour per child. But the government minister, Associate Minister Joe Luxton, says that if a centre opts in, it's going to be $13 an hour. Do you know which it is?
So the rates that I have seen, I thought were closer to $15 an hour.
$15 an hour.
So coming in early next year. So the point is that even that amount of money, you know, the cost that it actually takes to run a quality early childhood service is way in excess of that.
Yeah, the Associate Education Minister seems to be pushing back. Joe Luxton says that when she owned a childcare centre, she made the subsidy work for 3 to 4 year olds, and it should not be any different for two-year-olds.
No, this is completely different. If I'm correct, I think Minister Luxton actually owned a centre quite some time ago. The whole dynamic has changed in this time. In fact, you know, the increase in costs for early childhood services has gone through the roof. And incredibly, you know, very much compliance costs, which are coming through from government changes, have made it much more difficult for services to remain afloat. And also, to say again, to the point about ratios, the key aspect about why it's more expensive for two-year-olds is because we need to provide additional teachers for quality care and education of toddlers.
If a centre doesn't like it and doesn't like the terms and conditions that come with this funding, why don't they just say, no thanks?
Because unfortunately, that will drive parent fees through the roof. But that is, so we're really caught with our hands behind our backs.
Why would it drive parent fees through the roof?
So if you don't get the subsidy, and this is the other thing about another condition, which is that you can't just say, look, I'll continue to operate my 3 to 5 year olds under the subsidy, but actually thanks but no thanks for the 2 year olds, that's not going to work for us. It's a full opt-in or full opt-out.
It does seem counterintuitive, though. I mean, the government's throwing money at the sector, or, you know, and yet the sector says it's going to force the closure of centres. How do the two marry up?
Sure. So if we can actually implement this policy under the current conditions, it's an absolute win for everybody involved. We can do that from tomorrow. So we can already utilise the subsidy that's coming through for 2-year-olds, and we can then also ask for co-payments from parents to be able to provide additional teaching.
So why are the terms and conditions changed from 3 to 4 to 5-year-olds to 2-year-olds?
Look, that's, we are very perplexed about that as well. I don't understand the need for it at all, and we haven't had any explanation as to why that's required. It's just unnecessary, and in fact, it's counterintuitive, as I said, to their own early learning action plan. It's also going to be, we can't then deliver and reduce the fees for the parents, and we want to do that.
How would you describe the government's consultation on this policy?
There just hasn't been any.
None.
None at all. None at all. And, you know, they have our, look, we speak to them regularly. They have our email addresses. They have our phone numbers. We work closely with them. So I can't understand at all why they didn't just come and actually talk to us beforehand and say, what about this as an idea? Would this work?
So you're saying that the fees, like $15 subsidy, is not enough. So are you asking for more money, or are you just asking for consultation? What do you really want?
We don't need more money. We don't need more money. This is a huge investment in our sector, and we are absolutely thrilled. But allow us to actually implement it under the same conditions that we currently operate. It's as simple as that.
So if I'm a parent, should I feel confident under this system about the care that my 2-year-old would get in a childcare centre?
Under the current system or under the proposed?
New system.
Under the new system. Oh, look, it's very concerning. It really is concerning. But at the end of the day, I can tell you that our services will simply not put children's safety at risk. That is just, and nobody, not only in New Shoots, but for across the services. These are people who fundamentally care about the quality care and education of children. We are not going to put children's needs at risk. But the problem is that we're going to have to find other ways to stay afloat. That will be either through increasing parent fees, and I guess that's a conversation with parents, like, you know, what do we want to do to make sure your child is safe and well cared for, or do we reduce our opening hours? But we would have to find ways that effectively still disadvantage our families and communities.
Will centres go out of business because of this policy?
I think there's a high chance of it. In fact, if I can talk to that, I've just had the data through this morning. 719 centres have closed since June 2022. June 2022, and to give you some context of
but
that...
That's not under this new policy, though.
No, it's not. So, but that shows you that services are already on the brink, and this is just driving us further into that space. This is not good. This is unrequired. And in fact, it's just counterintuitive to what this policy should be able to deliver.
I mean, you're a centre owner, runner, manager, but from a parent's point of view, would you put your own 2-year-old into care under this scheme?
That's a really hard question. I know that in my service that I would do everything that I can to make sure we deliver quality, or I would close. Actually, to be honest, or I'd close. If I can't deliver quality for those children, then what are we here for? I mean, let's be honest. We are here to look after children. We're here to serve our families and our communities. If we can't do that properly, then what is this about? I mean, we're here to look after our most vulnerable New Zealanders. And we need to make sure that we can do that. And if that's, you know, with the government and working together to make that happen, wonderful. But if we can't deliver under these new conditions, then what's the point?
Kelly Seaberg, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Simon.
And we put Kelly's concerns to Associate Minister Jo Luxton. She gave us this statement, which says that the government wanted the 20 hours to be genuinely free. She said it's an opt-in subsidy, which centres don't have to offer. And because it doesn't come in until March next year, there is time to work with the sector. She said that budget commitments aren't consulted on, which has always been the case. OK, time now to go back to the Labour Party Electioneer Congress at Te Papa in Wellington. And Simon, it's been a bit of a rough week for Labour, hasn't it? That poll on Thursday night would have been disappointing for them. So it's crucial, I suppose, that the party machine gets geared up for the election. Can you feel that down there?
Absolutely, you are so right. You know, a bit of a polling bump for Labour there. And yes, you can feel that in the room. It is packed. Everybody's lovely. Everybody's rocked up. You dipped into Kelvin's speech early in the program, and he kicked off all the sort of Jacinda Ardern talking points of poverty, kindness, compassion, housing, those kinds of things. And he got a rah-rah and a bit of hoopla for each of those. No real stage diving at this stage, I guess, to say, but they are really sort of rocked up. We've been kicked out. We were in the conference before. We've been kicked out because they had have a closed-door session with Megan Woods, the minister, who's also the campaign chair, and so she's strategising to the party faithful about the rubber on the road to election. Then after that, interestingly, Willie Jackson is holding a session on Māori seats, and of course, you know, we saw Meka Whaitere dump Labor at the last minute, didn't even give Chippy a phone call, and they're going to be strategising about what to do about the Māori seats, so crucial to them. But there's no mention of anybody talking about the poll that you just mentioned publicly, but behind closed doors, you can be sure that they'll be using it as a motivator to show that it's tight. I mean, sure, Chris Hipkins is slightly ahead of Christopher Luxon in the personal popularity of PM, but you know, it's the party vote that counts, isn't it? And Te Pāti Māori, you know, being up there, they're going to have to woo them, and Te Pāti Māori could possibly be the kingy maker or the Chris maker. So they'll be using that poll as a motivator for the party faithful.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a good one to get them motivated there, Simon. And what do you think we can expect from the Prime Minister's speech tomorrow?
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. Such a contrast to the popularity and the ardour and adoration of previous years. I mean, as you know, as we know, he likes sausage rolls repeatedly. It's becoming a bit, you know, a bit of a well-worn cliche, I think. So it's going to be interesting. He's got to outline what he brings to the role. Is he more than just the bread and butter politician? He's got to show his positive vision for the party leading towards the election. He's shown us what he can cut, but he's now got to show us what his positive vision is for the party leading up to October. We are expecting a small policy announcement, possibly around Chris Hipkins' favourite portfolio, which is education. But really, it's going to be a back-to-basic speech, and it'll be really interesting to see the comparison with how the Labor Party faithful reacts to Chris Hipkins as opposed to the Jacinda Ardern era.
Yeah, absolutely, Simon. And I do hope, for all our sakes, that they ditch the sausage rolls. Thanks so much for joining us all the way from Wellington.
There's not a sausage roll in sight here.
Good, I'm so happy to hear it. Thank you, Simon. That is all from us for now. Thank you for watching, and we will see you again next weekend.
He mea tōnaki te hōtaka nei, nā te Public Interest Journalism Fund.